That's world-renowned drummer and percussionist Mokhta Samba with Drum and African Rhythm Part 1. This is from a series he did in 2013 demonstrating African rhythms titled Mokhta Samba, Man of Rhythm. Mokhta is Senegalese and Moroccan. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And in a way, the music gives us a place to go with the focus of our story today. We're talking again about the Clinton Foundation based on new documents released all over the weekend and including today, this morning, in which Morocco came up in a very interesting way. I want to remind you that we've been focusing on the Clinton Foundation as an enterprise that defies all of the laws, or practically all of the laws, of charity, and so far has not yet been nailed. Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton so far have escaped legal scrutiny, and it is mind-boggling because the emails that we are seeing are clear evidence that something very, very wrong was going on with this mega so-called philanthropic empire built by the Clintons. Luckily, we have as our guide, he has been walking us through this, and we are so grateful to have Charles Ortel, former Wall Street financial analyst and the leading expert on the Clinton Foundation, walk us through this complex maze of documents and the interplay between and among several individuals who have authority here and who therefore are accountable for the operations of the Clinton Foundation. And as you know, on the flip side of that, we've been saying all along that if you really want to get an idea of how corrupt this foundation is, you can't but look to Haiti. Haiti is where this whole thing starts to mushroom and we begin to make sense of the intricate connections between and among these so-called philanthropic organizations and entities operating under the aegis of the Clinton, the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation. Charles, great to have you with us again.
Well, thanks for having me on, Eutrice.
Obviously, you had no time at all over the weekend to yourself, going through this new batch of emails. But let's give an overview to where we are right now. What would you say have been the most significant releases so far that link directly to the trajectory that you've been following?
Well, I would say that, the interesting thing here, Eutrice, and for your listeners, is that with this set of public charities, unlike the matters that Peter Schweitzer has been trying to examine, the public corruption matters, there is a mound of public information already out there, all of which has to be truthful, complete, and accurate concerning each one of these charities. Now, what these WikiLeaks documents do, again, assuming they're accurate, and it's noteworthy, frankly, that the Clinton Foundation and none of the people touched by these documents have officially come out and discredited them, and I believe that's likely because these are true and accurate copies. I should also point out that so far, I believe it's the case that not a single WikiLeaks release has ever been anything other than 100% accurate. So these cables, I think we can assume, for the sake of discussion, are accurate. And what they show is that in stark contrast to the applicable rules and regulations and laws that require a charity to a public charity, the Clinton Foundation, the Global Initiative, the Health Access Initiative, Alliance for a Healthier Generation, Clinton, Bush, Haiti Fund, all of these organizations are not allowed, and their trustees are not allowed to engage in any, and I would put that in bold caps, any illegal activities, including filing false and materially misleading forms while they are out raising money using the telephone, using the internet, using the mails, with these false and materially misleading documents being in the public domain. These are major league solicitation crimes. And what you see when you see the WikiLeaks documents, the most telling by far is one we sort of touched on the last time we were together, and that is this memorandum from Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett. Now, that's a great law firm. I'll continue to say it's a great law firm, notwithstanding the comments I'm about to make. What we see in the WikiLeaks cables over the last 3 days is more evidence that with a filing, a final filing deadline of November 15th, 2011, coming at the Clinton Foundation, Chelsea Clinton was successful in getting Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett and their acknowledged world experts on New York and philanthropy law to take a hard look at the record, which they began to do after October 27th, 2011. The full set of cables is not yet in, but we see enough information. We know that there was a meeting on the 23rd of November 2011. That was the Wednesday afternoon before Thanksgiving, an oral and in-person meeting where some people were up in Chappaqua and some people were on the phone, where, quote, certain themes were discussed. Now, this is 8 days past the final filing deadline for 2010. And 2010 was a very significant year because that's the year in which the Clinton Foundation attempted, and I would argue illegally, attempted to reorganize itself. Instead of Simpson Thatcher forcing the Clintons to do the correct thing and beg for mercy and ask for some more time to try to file correct documents, Simpson Thatcher was, we see in the emails back and forth, they were very much still working with the Clinton Foundation. And these false and materially misleading filings for 2010 were, in fact, filed. Then on the 23rd, themes were discussed. And then by December 3rd, we have a memo. And we look at this memo. Anybody, you can all go online on WikiLeaks and find it. It's the governance review memo dated December 3rd, 2011. It's in draft form. It's 22 pages long. And it is an exposition of all the frauds that this entity had committed and was in the process of committing and continued to commit and is still committing to this day. The significance of this is that there's a special provision under New York law I'm aware of, and Victoria Bjorklund, who is named as the lead lawyer on this case, is certainly aware of it because she wrote a textbook about New York nonprofit corporation law in 1997 that subsequently has had multiple editions. She's the dean of the philanthropic bar, or was when she was active. She certainly would know that there's something called a material adverse change provision, that if anything happens in the documents to your charity after you filed the documents that is adverse to what you claimed was the case in your documents, you're required to notify the public and to attempt to correct it. So instead of doing that, the Simpson Thatcher team and the Clinton Foundation personnel, including Chelsea and her father, elected rather than to fix it, to try to cover it up and to continue aggressively with fundraising. Now, what was this? Another thing that came up, Beatrice, is that we now know, because it's interesting, there's an author named Joe Connison, who is hardly...
Oh, I know Joe.
Yeah, all right. So Joe is not exactly a conservative Republican or fan of Republican candidates, and he's authored this book called Man of the World, which I was urged to buy, and I reluctantly did. And I will say, if Joe's listening or if you speak to him, that it's very well done. It's very interesting. But unfortunately for Mr. Connison and the Clintons, Joe was not instructed on charity law. So what this is a blanket confession of gross charity fraud in his book, chapter and verse. He takes you through the origin of the Clinton Foundation, the troubled way in which they got the campus built. He takes you through the early years when Ira Magaziner and Bill Clinton illegally raised money from the government of Canada, the government of Norway, the government of Ireland in massive quantity without disclosing any of this in the Clinton Foundation filings. And he attempts to paint a glowing picture of what Bill and Ira were trying to do to change the world for the better. But no one took him aside and said, hey, Joe, you know, there's this rule. It's called inurement. And insiders in a charity like Bill Clinton and Doug Band are not allowed to appropriate private gain, you know, compensation, equity interests, et cetera, for themselves through the operation of a charity. You're just not allowed to do it. You go and you look at this book. I have a copy, so and I'm not giving it back if he attempts to recall all the copies. And I will be giving it to lawyers. In fact, I have a conference call this afternoon to discuss this. It is a massive confession of charity fraud. It discusses in here how Bill Clinton accepted a position as chairman of the Teneo Advisory Board in 2011, again, right as Simpson Thatcher is doing this work, where supposedly he was being paid at a rate of $3.5 million per year to be advisory board member of Teneo. And Teneo, we know from many different ways, was and may still be actively involved working with donors to the Clinton Foundation and in working and concocting different projects around the world through the intercession of introductions that Bill Clinton and his Rolodex transferred to Doug Band. So, I mean, a lot is going on here. And to make it very simple, those of us who are involved in charity, you know, most humans across the political spectrum, when we think about charity, it's about selfless help. It's about, you know, if you're going to take your time away from your family and friends, away from your obligations at work, away from other things you might want to do, and you get to get involved in charity, most people are honestly trying to do good works selflessly. They're not trying to gain through a charity, particularly anybody who has taken 30 seconds to read about, you know, how charities work and the strict rules on conflicts of interest and stuff like that. So what you see in the Clinton record and the WikiLeaks record, and I have my views about Julian Assange, on balance here, you know, I have to say that what he's done is he's done the world a service exposing this and the flood of WikiLeaks cables here. I mean, I'm lucky I don't sleep that much, and I'm also lucky I don't have much of a life, so I can read all this stuff. But, I mean, it's just you read it, and if you know anything at all about a charity law, you wonder, you know, where were the grown-ups? There's a picture painted here that Chelsea, you know, is growing into her role as a, you know, not just simply being the daughter of two famous people and trying to do, in theory, some good works here. And it's what I see in the various cables is that Chelsea thought that, you know, she had her father's ear and that she and her father and mother were truly going to try to reorganize this. Whereas it seems to me that John Podesta and Cheryl Mills and Justin Cooper and Doug Band, they had been milking Bill Clinton's Rolodex for their personal benefits. And there's abundant evidence that where Chelsea was going down one path, you know, the four I just mentioned were saying, oh, wait a minute, you know, we don't want to upset this apple cart, and she doesn't really know what's going on. And Bill probably is in the position where he can't really tell Chelsea what it is that the whole Team Clinton has been up to, not simply in his post-presidency, from the very beginning. So, you know, there's that famous book that John Kennedy took credit for writing, and I believe somebody else may have written, called Profiles in Courage. This is a Profiles in Courage moment. You know, this is a moment where we can look at this string of charities and we can finally peel away the skin and look into the body of it, and we can see it for what it is. This is a corrupt slush fund that has been standing in front of gigantic sums of aid. It provides cover for deal makers and bankers and lawyers and accountants and consultants and political operatives to get together in smoky rooms, maybe not so smoky anymore, and concoct these gigantic deals that either serve them personally and or help them politically, and, you know, preen in front of the public claiming that they're philanthropists when they're far from it. And this is the kind of behavior, whether it's done in a Republican under the cloak of a Republican group or a Democrat group or a progressive group or you name it, it's got to stop, because we do have some serious problems in this country, and we need to stop, you know, talking past one another, understand the nature of the problems, and, you know, get to fixing them.
And by the time Chelsea Clinton decided to rev up her role in the foundation, she certainly had gotten some really scary clues that things were way out of whack. You had an officer calling her one evening saying that she was in her car facing the river with one foot on the gas pedal and was considering killing herself because the turmoil within the foundation, and by then clearly things had begun to unravel and people were beginning to get really scared about how they were going to explain, should anybody come calling for explanations, how would they explain this gigantic mess, this cesspool of an enterprise posing as a philanthropy, and her good name is wrapped up in it, and all of that. She was actually at the point of killing herself. So, what was it that triggered in Chelsea Clinton this move that she made to hire Simpson Thacher Bartlett, the well-known international law firm, Wall Street based, to take a look at the situation as it was, and to give them a good picture of what was going on, and possibly even how to deal with it. From your reading of these documents, the WikiLeaks documents, do you get a sense that Chelsea now began her term of doing sleight of hand management at the Clinton Foundation, because the situation was just so enormous that they needed the cover of a credible organization, and they needed to demonstrate to whomever might come later on to investigate that they were at least trying to get back on track?
Well, you know, I'm just reading between the lines and to, you know, basically speculating. But when I read through the large body of information that is available, and then I weigh it up against Joe's book, which I read about, say, two-thirds of it. But, you know, again, other of his books I didn't particularly like, but this is pretty good. I get the following sense that you know, Chelsea, I don't know how old she is now, but back then she was, I think, in her 30s, maybe her early 30s. And, you know, she had had this period in her life where she had gone to various schools and had various jobs, and nothing really had stuck. And then she apparently went down to Haiti. We know this from the other WikiLeaks cables, where she sends this lengthy plaintiff email to her mother and father that basically tears apart what was going on down in Haiti, and is very, very critical of Haiti. We know from Joe's book that apparently when she was at Oxford, she wrote a thesis about the creation of the Global Fund, which is the large entity that you know, was trying to fight HIV/AIDS and malaria and tuberculosis around the world. And we know so we know that she has some training. She's competent to evaluate. She's smart, obviously, to evaluate these health issues. So. She got involved with these various things. She got involved with her mother's campaign. The mother didn't win. She finished her PhD at Columbia, and then she went down to Haiti in, I think, in 2010, and was horrified. There ensued a period where she must have been, you know, fighting back and forth with the old guard, Bruce Lindsay and others, to try to rein in this mess. Under President Obama's first year as a guest, we haven't seen the emails, which I'm sure are going to be rich with, they're going to be sad and humorous at the same time, because there are going to be a bunch of emails where Team Obama's people are going to be saying, wait a minute, Team Clinton, you told us everything was fine, and we find this problem and that problem and another problem. You never were authorized properly to fight HIV/AIDS or the Global Initiative or Alliance for a Healthier Generation. We have to correct all this. We have to create new foundations. We're going to see those things going back and forth. How much of that Chelsea may have known, we'll find out. By 2010, the dam breaks in Haiti. She goes down there. She's horrified. She starts saying things aren't right. Then stories emerge about Doug Band in the press generally, and what Teneo and Band may have been up to, creating deals off the back of Bill Clinton's Rolodex. Jealousy ensues. Teneo gets formed, and this is Doug Band's consulting company, which in theory Bill Clinton is going to be a chairman of the advisory board. Tony Blair is involved in that. People begin to ask questions about Teneo. Chelsea agitates, she agitates, and finally she, I believe, is successful in convincing Simpson-Thatcher to take a hard look at it. And this is, you know, the choice of Simpson-Thatcher to take a look at the Clinton Foundation, it's not like you're asking some, you know, three-person shop that's a divorce lawyer's firm, you know, because you understand how to do divorce law, take a look at a foundation. No, this is, you know, the world's experts, specifically in how philanthropy works, U.S. philanthropy and international philanthropy, and specifically on how what New York laws are, sinks their teeth, makes a request. We have the preliminary, the first request. It is a devastating request. You know, if the request was answered, then the request was sent on the 28th of October, 2011. It's a seven-page list. It's very detailed. It's asking for all kinds of information that, if provided, would have told Victoria Bjorklund and her colleague Jennifer Reynoso and another associate named Jordan Botcher, they would have figured out in less than an hour that this was a massive fraud and there were massive problems. So the question is, you know, and what must have been going on here is the Simpson-Thatcher team's looking at this and saying, oh, my God, how do we put this back together again? What do? We can't put too much in writing, even though it's privileged and confidential. I don't think they anticipated WikiLeaks would get this stuff. But there must be all kinds of side communications back and forth saying, what do we do? What do we do? And the problem is, it's not just the Clinton Foundation. By 2011, multiple large foundations, the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, a long list of prominent foundations, have given money to various parts of the Clinton Foundation, including the main corpus. And unfortunately, all of these Clinton Foundation entities were neither organized nor operated lawfully. And the way charity laws work in this country, after, I think it was 1969, the laws were tightened because the operation of private foundations was so sloppy, to put special requirements on the backs of donors. So on the Gates Foundation, on the Rockefeller Foundation, that before you send money to a charity you characterize as being charity, you better make sure that it is a charity, that it's operated and organized lawfully. Well, the Clinton Foundation entities have never been operated and organized lawfully. And so now you've got a problem at Simpson-Thatcher. One of their clients, because we see this in the emails, is George Soros and his foundations. George Soros Foundation, the U.S. one, in theory, gave money to the Clinton Foundation HIV-AIDS operation in 2004. We know this because we found the 2004 annual report to the IRS is on file in Massachusetts for this entity, and it specifically it has the names of all the donors, and it says Soros Foundation, based in New York, for roughly $1 million. That's a huge problem for the Soros Foundation, if indeed it went from the Soros Foundation and not from him personally. So here we are at Simpson-Thatcher, and we're doing work for the Clinton Foundation, and because, you know, this practice is so special, they do work for lots and lots of foundations, and the penny must have dropped at Simpson-Thatcher saying, my goodness, you know, if we expose the problems at the Clinton Foundation, we're then exposing problems for the Rockefeller Foundation and the Gates Foundation and scores of other large foundations. Now, I don't know which of those the Simpson-Thatcher may also have served, but this is, you know, Chelsea, through her interest in, you know, putting things right, gives this assignment to Simpson-Thatcher. They make the request for all this information. We don't know yet how much of the information Simpson-Thatcher actually got, but as a guess, they got enough to know right away this was a gigantic problem. And instead of doing the right thing, which I would argue would have been to say to the Clinton Foundation, listen, you know, you need to forthwith correct all of your historical filings going back to the first year, which would have been October 23rd, 97, to December 31st, 1997, when they failed to file a report for that year. Every subsequent report is wrong. You need to collect all these, correct all these, you know, think through how you're going to make right of this, but you need to put it right, and you've got to stop fundraising immediately until you do all that. And instead of giving that advice, Simpson-Thatcher, for whatever sets of reasons, it seems, elected to just cooperate and attempt to cover up this massive charity fraud. It's a serious set of issues.
But in the meantime, the Clinton Foundation and its senior officers knew that not only that they were doing wrong things, but that they had been detected, they had been found out. But they continued, Hillary Clinton continued and Bill Clinton continued to solicit money, lots and lots of money, without paying attention to the fact that at any minute they could have been busted. And this is serious, serious fraud, as you say. So how did she get away with this? This is Hillary now. How did Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton and the key operatives here, the key people who were running this foundation, how did they manage under, having triggered a look-see at the foundation by Chelsea Clinton and by Simpson Thatcher Bartlett, how did they rationalize this dogged determination to just get as much money as possible?
Well, as a guess, here in New York, now we have Andrew Cuomo as governor, and we've got Mr. Schneiderman as attorney general. In 2011, I'd have to check. I don't know whether Cuomo was attorney general or governor back then. But the Clintons may have felt that as far as exposure under New York state law and as far as exposure under Massachusetts state law and California state law, that they were covered, that none of those authorities would ever make an issue. And under Arkansas state law, maybe they felt they were covered. So that they knew, you know, there's one thing to break the law, and then it's another thing, as we discovered with Comey and the private server and Loretta Lynch, you know, whether or not the authorities decide to make an issue of it. So maybe the top-level operatives in Team Clinton, you know, had to take somebody aside and say, look, yeah, we know it's a mess, but we got that covered. You know, nobody's going to make an issue of it. So, you know, we have time now to try to cover this up. And, of course, you know, once Hillary wins, you know, we'll do good. We'll make, you know, we know we've made a mistake here and we'll cover it up. Don't worry, Chelsea. You know, we'll make this right. But, you know, we can't expose this because to do it, we'd be blowing up, you know, the entire philanthropic world, including Bill Gates' foundation and others. So, and I'm speculating now, but I'm just imagining that that's, you know, one line of reasoning. And then as far as the federal IRS situation is concerned, back in 2011-12, Lois Lerner was still in charge of the tax-exempt department of the IRS. And we know a woman named Kathy Keneally, who was, I think, and may still be associated with another law firm, DLA Piper, was on the inside of the Department of Justice at one point. I'm not exactly sure whether it was around this or slightly after it. So the Clintons may have felt that, you know, they had links into the IRS, the IRS wouldn't make an issue of it, and they had links into the Department of Justice, and that the people there could be persuaded not to elevate this problem to a prosecution. And they may have, you know, had the view that, yeah, it's a mess, yeah, there are problems, but we can't stop it, because that would signal the problems, and we can't correct it. So we got to keep going and hope that Hillary crosses the line. And once she crosses the line, then we'll really bury it. We'll cover it all up. And then
I thought it was interesting that even as she began to consider running for president and began to, of course, raise money, there was also a discussion about using Barack Obama's executive privilege to protect the foundation should anything show up that they needed to defend themselves against. And there was this back and forth about should emails to Barack Obama and from Obama to Hillary Clinton, should it come to that where they would be subpoenaed or whatever, what should we do? I thought the document also suggested that they expected coverage from the White House.
Well, you see, and yeah, I was going to say there's another dimension here, which is, of course, the international dimension. That, you know, it's we in America are very happy to believe that, you know, whatever we do here in our boundaries, you know, is so important that, you know, everyone will just, you know, let us play out the game and not really bother us. But this is a global matter. And there are a lot of foreign donors who've given money. There are a lot of foreign nations. You mentioned Haiti. There's Papua New Guinea. There's Mozambique. There are many places where the Clinton Foundation has, in my view, been operating illegally, soliciting money illegally, operating illegally, claiming they're doing good when, in fact, they're doing very bad things with this HIV/AIDS drugs that I believe were adulterated and distributed negligently by the Clinton Foundation and through the offices of the Clinton Foundation. So there are a lot of international players looking at this. And as a guess, the Clintons felt, given Hillary's experience at state and Bill's as president, that they could stiff-arm the foreign governments under a theory that they could say, listen, you know, you may think this is an issue, but if it were an issue, the IRS and the DOJ and the attorneys general would have gone after us, and they haven't. And the reason they haven't, I assure you, my friend in Australia, is that it isn't an issue. So the Clintons felt that they could basically continue their practice, their two-pronged strategy, that is to say Hillary and Bill's strategy, of lying under oath and obstructing justice, and that they could stall, play for time, and play for this big prize of Hillary being put in power as president of the United States. So, you know, it's quite a drama going on here. And, you know, the WikiLeaks people are doing a tremendous service to us exposing this. On the question of Barack Obama using executive privilege or pardon power to provide cover, yeah, he could provide some cover. I mean, his personal emails to and from Hillary and others, they could certainly guard using executive privilege. But there, you know, there's an interesting point. Unlike Bill Clinton, who has famously said, and Hillary and others have said, that Bill Clinton doesn't like to email, we know from multiple pictures and, you know, multiple reports that Barack Obama was a blueberry addict, BlackBerry addict. You know, remember he was always seen using a BlackBerry, and then once he became president-elect, there were lots of stories about how, you know, he wanted to have his BlackBerry going forward. How do we do this? You know, and it was a huge tussle. It's a security risk, and ultimately he got one. Hillary wanted one. She wasn't allowed to have one. So we know that Barack Obama likes using email via BlackBerry, and we know he knows how to do it. And most of us who are, I'll confess I'm addicted to email, as I think you know, Yatrice. But I always look at, you know, the way I decide whether or not I'm going to read an email is not the subject matter, but who's it from. And so I always look at the address. And don't tell me that, you know, Barack Obama wouldn't have noticed that, you know, Hillary Clinton was sending him email from a non-government address. Now, maybe the reason he hasn't made an issue of it yet is because he might have been doing the same thing. Maybe he was sending personal emails as well. And perhaps that is the reason that the Clintons feel that they have running room here. But as far as waving a magic wand, I mean, Barack Obama could put his finger on the scales of justice and encourage, it would not be a great thing to do, but he could encourage the Attorney General and the authorities not to go after this. He could certainly obstruct the process of getting his own emails validly in that case. But I just thought
it was just so incredible that the minions working at the Clinton Foundation, Cheryl Mills and others, Podesta and others, were actually discussing way ahead of time the possibility that should any problem arise, they could kind of count on protection from the White House via executive orders and executive privilege. And that says to me, you know, we've talked about this, there is no way that this foundation and its related entities could have been engaging in this level of fraud without Barack Obama knowing. He should have known this even at the outset, in the early stages, when Hillary Clinton was being considered for Secretary of State. somebody should have said, there's a little problem here with the way the Clintons have been doing business. And this should have come to his attention. And I'm assuming that it did. And I'm assuming also that there was a cover-up at that level as well.
Well, you raised some excellent points as usual. I mean, the first issue, I just remind everybody that in 2010, Barack Obama and Michelle Obama were very gracious and gave more than $200,000 out of Barack's Nobel Peace Prize winnings to the Clinton-Bush 80 Fund in 2010. And there's a paper trail on that. It's in the public domain. You just Google it for yourselves. You'll see what I'm talking about. They gave a first slug of money out of his winnings, and then later in the year they gave a smaller amount. I want to say it's another $15,000 to this Clinton-Bush 80 fraud, which the documents are all wrong. So if you expose that fraud, you create a small tax liability, large for most of us, but for him, small. Say it's a $150,000 bill with penalties and interest by exposing the Clinton-Bush 80 thing. So, you know, that's one little thing people may have known about. The second issue that, you know, really deserves a lot more scrutiny, and only I, who am so close to this, only just began to think about this. Cheryl Mills is very clearly directing the activities of all of these entities when you look at the emails. She is the one doing the heavy lifting, you know, maneuvering all the people, the warring parties, Chelsea, you know, Podesta, et cetera. She's thick in this all through this period. Now, last I checked, I believe Cheryl Mills was a full-time employee of the State Department. And at the same time, she's named as a trustee of the Clinton Foundation. You're not supposed to do that. And there's special rules on conflicts of interest. In addition, she is directing traffic down in Haiti. She has State Department responsibility for the Haiti relief effort. And her domestic partner, I forget his first name, but his last name is Domenici, is also involved down in Haiti with a foundation. You know, none of these conflicts are disclosed. So she's got her own suite of problems. I wonder how many of them Simpson Thatcher knew about. But, you know, you look through these emails, she's all over the emails. She's directing them, she's managing it, she's managing the conflicts. She's, as I say, trying to, you know, negotiate with the various warring parties, the Doug Bands, the Chelsea Clintons, and others. To say that she was just a passive role, I mean, no, she was in the center of this. How can you be in the center of this mess while you're also, in theory, serving our country in a very senior role as leader of the State Department and with a straight face claim that you're, you know, not tarred by these conflicts of interest? And then afterwards, how can Cheryl Mills set up this firm Black Ivy, which is sort of a mini version of Teneo, or, you know, harvesting contacts that she may have derived through government and, quote, service to do all these international deals around the world? I mean, this is an example here of blurred lines. You know, and I think you see it very clearly that you have the people supposedly working for the foundation wearing many hats at once, breaking the strict laws, which are that you must, if you're going to be a charity, you must be exclusively a charity. You must exclusively serve a public interest. No, that's not what they're doing here. There's a whole bunch of people in these secret offices, in the Harlem office, the secret 77 Water Street office, working on for-profit and not-for-profit and personal and political and all this stuff, just as Bill Clinton is doing around the world. And for a long period of time, while Hillary Clinton is Secretary of State, it seems so obvious. It's as if, you know, you can have a small problem. It's easy to land on a small problem. It's easy to land on, and Corinne Brown probably doesn't think it's a very small problem, but it's easy to land on an $800,000 slush fund involving one long-serving African-American congressperson based in Florida, because it's $800,000. You don't blow up the whole not-for-profit sector. But here you have, you know, the force of federal justice pounding her, pounding Corinne Brown, threatening her with 357 years in federal prison. And meanwhile, you have this collection of rogues, the former president, the aspiring president, the daughter, who's maybe a do-gooder, maybe not, the jury's out. This poor Laura Graham, who seems to be somebody who, the most shocking thing about the email you were talking about earlier, Utrice, is that when she talks about putting her foot on the pedal about to kill herself, I think Doug Band says that isn't the first time she tried. You know, so there's been enormous stress here. Some people, you know this is far outside the law. There have been numerous actual articles. There's one back in 2007 in the Atlantic, again, not exactly a conservative Republican publication, describing this whole mess. And the title of the article is, "This is Not Charity." You know, you would think that if you're Simpson Thatcher, an associate, you know, partner might have said, you know, why don't we get any articles that have been written about this to see if anybody's found anything we should know about? And here you see this thing. This is not charity. It comes out, I want to say, sometime in 2007, just as Bill Clinton writes a book called Giving, which I think was published September 5th, 2007, in which he's paid roughly $6 million personally for writing a book about his charity. Again, that is called inurement. That is, you're not supposed to do that. And so you have the stuff that's these big, fat things that are sitting out there. You have Bill Clinton taking, you know, millions of dollars from a for-profit joint venture partner in Clinton Global Initiative University, and the family receiving ultimately almost $18 million for part-time work there. You would have thought the Simpson-Thatcher team would say, you know what, there's a limit here. You know, I'm a world expert on charity. You're supposed to operate charities exclusively for the serve public interest. We're not doing that here. You know, we got to stop this merry-go-round, see whether we can correct it. If we can correct it, let's correct it and then move on. But we can't cover it up. And that is not, it seems, what the public record shows us so far.
Well, here's what Hillary Clinton said to correct the record. This was at the last and final, the merciful last and final debate, being questioned by Chris Wallace.
During your 2009 Senate confirmation hearing, you promised to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest with your dealing with the Clinton Foundation while you were Secretary of State. But emails show that donors got special access to you. Those seeking grants for Haiti relief were considered separately from non-donors, and some of those donors got government contracts, taxpayer money. Can you really say that you kept your pledge to that Senate committee? And why isn't what happened and what went on between you and the Clinton Foundation, why isn't it what Mr. Trump calls pay to play?
Well, everything I did as Secretary of State was in furtherance of our country's interests and our values. The State Department has said that. I think that's been proven. But I am happy. In fact, I'm thrilled to talk about the Clinton Foundation because it is a world-renowned charity. And I am so proud of the work that it does. You know, I could talk for the rest of the debate. I know I don't have the time to do that. But just briefly, the Clinton Foundation made it possible for 11 million people around the world with HIV/AIDS to afford treatment. And that's about half of all the people in the world who are getting treatment. In partnership with the American Health Association, we have made environments and schools healthier for kids,
Secretary
including
Clinton,
healthier lunches.
Respectfully, this is an open discussion.
Well, it is an open discussion.
I understand, and the specific question went to pay for play. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, there is a lot of evidence about the very good work
and it's a criminal enterprise, and so
many people know
it. It's a criminal enterprise. Saudi Arabia giving $25 million, Qatar, all of these countries. You talk about women and women's rights. So these are people that push gays off business, off buildings. These are people that kill women and treat women horribly, and yet you take their money. So I'd like to ask you right now, why don't you give back the money that you've taken from certain countries that treat certain groups of people so horribly? Why don't you give back the money? I think it would be a great gesture.
Well,
because she takes a tremendous amount of money, and you take a look at the people of Haiti. I was at a little Haiti the other day in Florida, and I want to tell you, they hate the Clintons, because what's happened in Haiti with the Clinton Foundation is a disgrace. And you know it, and they know it, and everybody knows
Secretary
it.
Clinton.
Well, very quickly, we at the Clinton Foundation spend 90% of all the money that is donated on behalf of programs of people around the world and in our own country.
Wow. Lots of figures being thrown around. But I think those figures that Hillary Clinton spouted would come back to haunt her. Now, in the meantime, many foreign governments that hadn't contributed hundreds of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation themselves have begun their own kind of movement demanding accountability for this money. The money may have been redirected for purposes they did not intend, or there was no accounting at all. What do you know about the foreign governments and this effort that is kind of beginning to build to a point of critical mass here, demanding accountability from the Clinton Foundation?
Well, what we know, Yatrice, is that that the Clinton Foundation was required and is required to, in its federal tax forms, to calculate how much money they received in total from all government sources and to enter that amount on a line. Every question that's asked on the tax form must be answered truthfully. And to enter a line that says, you know, out of our total revenue, we got so much in this year from governments. And they have never done that for 1998 through 2007. Those are crucial years because the complex was built starting in, I want to say, 2001 or so, using some donations from governments, and other government donations started to come in 2005 and 6 and 7. And the Clinton Foundation has refused to fill that information in on their historical tax forms, for the federal tax forms. Then in New York State, beginning in 2004, the Clinton Foundation was required to do more than that, to reconcile that government total and present a list explaining each government donation, so that if the government of France gave them 17 donations, every single one of those donations had to be listed out on the New York State form for every single government, foreign and domestic, and other filers do that properly. And the reason is because, you know, it's a little bit unusual for American charities to get government donations. And what the reason for the requirement in New York is that New Yorkers are experienced, sadly, with fraud. There have been lots of frauds here, and it's very expensive to campaign for office. And charities can be used as, you know, illegally used as more tax-efficient means to get government into the government donations into the hands of political candidates. So that's the reason for that special provision. It's I think Schedule 4B on the CHAR 500 form, CHAR 500 form here in New York. They never filled that out properly either for 2004, 5, 6, 7. Now, why is that interesting? It's particularly interesting because as part of this jockeying back and forth to get Hillary across the line and confirmed in the Senate, they agreed that the Clinton's team agreed that they would make disclosures concerning, quote, all of their donors, their cumulative donations from the very beginning right the way through. And it's unclear whether that's through December 31, 2007, or through the date on which they made this release, December 18th, 2008, they made a release, which you can see by Googling and prior versions up on the Clinton Foundation website, of all of their cumulative contributions. And those contributions show clearly that the government of Australia, the government of Ireland, the government of Norway, other governments of Qatar, Saudi Arabia, had made contributions between October 23, 1997, and either December 31, 2007, or December 18, 2008. They had made contributions, yet the Clinton Foundation elected not to correct their historical tax forms. That is fraud, right there. That they knowingly, and charity fraud you don't have to prove knowingly, but they knowingly failed. They had the information, and they knowingly failed to share it with the public while they were fundraising. And they've continued fundraising ever since.
What do you expect, because the trove of emails from WikiLeaks is a daily ceremony now. What do you expect that the next batch, or soon, we will learn about the inner workings of the foundation?
Well, I think we're going to see, and I mean, the pace at which these things are being released is just mind-numbing, but I think we're going to see more and more evidence of the filling out the fact that, that key people inside the Clinton Foundation and key advisors to the Clinton Foundation knew by that filing deadline, November 15th, 2011, that the Clinton Foundation filings were fraudulent. They were false and materially misleading. And that rather than cease fundraising, rather than confess to their crimes and atone for their sins, they decided instead to carry on and to try to cover it up. We're going to see more and more evidence of that. And there's a lot of email traffic here. There's an email from Chelsea Clinton that came out this morning, which, you know, basically, I think it's prior to the 15th of November, 2011, that says, wow, we really need to hurry up this Simpson-Thatcher review because otherwise, you know, our nonprofit status is in jeopardy. In other words, I think she understood from that email, you can tell, that what the danger was. I think she probably understood beforehand what the danger was, and that's why she pushed so hard to get Simpson-Thatcher in there. We're going to see more of that. We're going to see more emails like that. We're going to see more evidence. We might see there's a report referenced. I want to say it is November 18th, 2011. There's supposedly a memorandum. I want to say it's a 13 or 18-page memorandum from Doug Band concerning issues surrounding Teneo, the firm that he created. And as a guess, that is going to be explosive, that memo, because that's going to explain, you know, what he was doing with Bill Clinton, what he may have been doing in the past with Bill Clinton. It's going to be explosive.
And how would this affect Hillary Clinton? What do you think is the coup de grace here for her?
Well, you know, with Hillary, I'm not a political expert, although I, you know, took political science classes, you know, two centuries ago when I was in college. And I follow, obviously, the political scene. Just as an observer, as somebody who lives in a very progressive part of Manhattan, I contrast what I see walking around the West Village now with what I saw in 2008 when Barack Obama was close to winning. And there was massive enthusiasm back then for Barack Obama. There were Obama, you know, stickers and posters and pins. Everybody was walking around talking about it. Down here in the West Village and around Manhattan, you don't see that enthusiasm. And an important difference, 2016 versus 2008 for Hillary, a very dangerous one for her, is she is, after all, a former senator representing the state. You would have thought with this vaunted ground game of hers, she's raised so much money. There's so many. She's had so many fundraisers here in New York. You would have thought you would see buttons and stickers and posters and stuff for Hillary, but you don't see any of that here in New York. Now, maybe that's because the team thinks that New York is safe and that Donald Trump is going to lose handily. Maybe he will. But still, you don't see the signs of enthusiasm. And it strikes me, you know, again, I'm not a political expert. If you want more of the same, if you want four more years of this mess, if you want, you know, exploding health care premiums, if you want geopolitical mess, if you want an economy that's, you know, shedding jobs right and left, if you want more debt and disorder, by all means, embrace Hillary Clinton. I mean, that seems to be what she's stuck with. And Donald Trump, you know, he's expressed some views. We don't really know because nobody can know how to deal with it. Nobody knows what the future portends exactly. But he seems to be fighting on the argument that, you know, look, I am going to change the system. The Republican establishment, I'm fighting them as much as I'm fighting Hillary. And I think there's some evidence of that, actually. So, you know, in Hillary, what you're forced to do, I think, is defend the indefensible. I mean, she can't say, you know, I'm going to go to Washington and sweep the place clean. She's a creature of Washington. She's been there since 1993. She's been feasting off Washington, not to mention with these speeches and everything else. So it's a very interesting period, Yatrice. I've never seen anything like it. I wish I could predict the future, and in which case I'd probably be, I don't know, playing the horses. But it sure looks to me, though, that that Hillary, I think, is in serious trouble here. And the team that is trying to project inevitability is, you know, by these polls that seem to be rigged, is only playing into Trump's hands.
Well, we leave it there for today. And we will come back again once you've had a chance to look at this mountain of emails and documents, and whether you can make sense of them for us. It would be great, because I know it takes a lot of time to develop a timeline and to follow the tracks to come up with a picture, but that's what you're so good at. And that's what brought down General Electric and AIG and the companies that you trained your eyes on and showed fraud long before it became a big issue on Wall Street. Thanks so much for being with us today, Charles.
Thank you, Trish.
Thanks. That brings us to the end of the program. Meditations and Molotovs with Vincent Emanuele is next. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. And you don't want to miss tomorrow's program. That's all I'm going to tell you. Bye-bye.